You know, everybody would be happy. Those formulas are there. It's not that I'm inventing them. They are there. The thing is that they don't have enough press, voice, funding, whatever, yet. But we, if we portray them, if we focus on them, on the healing capabilities that these projects can have, then people will invest. And these future scenarios of better life together can happen. I think I'm a believer of that. Also realistic, that it's not probable. The prognosis is taking us to a very bad and dark direction. But we have therapeutics for this, and those therapeutics are based on dialogue and transforming hate into love emotions, you know? Not that complex, but difficult.
Hello there. My name is Duncan Autry, and you are listening to Fractal Friends, the podcast where we explore our self-similarity across our diversity. We all have a role to play in the whole, and the purpose of the show is to interview people with interesting perspectives on the world and see what it is that we can learn from one another. In this episode, I talk with Pablo Lumerman. Pablo is a conflict transformation colleague of mine from Argentina. We worked together over 5 years ago at Fundación Cambio Democrático, the Foundation for Democratic Change in Buenos Aires. He now lives in the Neuquén province in Patagonia. In this conversation, we talk about the power of being in the now and living in the present moment, which gets us quickly into a discussion about the importance of considering deep history and long-reaching visions for the future. We get into a comparative history of colonialism, race, and racism between Argentina and the United States. And this leads us to drawing parallels between colonialism and gentrification and prompts us to ponder how laws, documentation, and bureaucracy are forms of cultural colonization that undermine both indigenous culture and the culture of dialogue. As students and practitioners of conflict transformation, we obviously talk about the powerful potential of dialogue to help us reach across our differences and facilitate healing. This is especially important because these days in particular, we absolutely need to be able to effectively engage with each other across our differences. And given where this conversation started, we talk about how the transformation of conflict requires us to think beyond neutrality so that we don't risk repeating patterns of oppression. This episode is awesome. I'm so excited to share it with you. And it perfectly fits into this season's theme by taking a hard look at reality and history while also providing practical, possible, and optimistic paths towards a future that we all want to live in. Thank you for listening to Fractal Friends. If you enjoy this show, please subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening to it, and please give it a review. And come visit fractalfriends.us, where you can get more information about Pablo and the things we discuss in this episode. The webpage for this episode has useful content about conflict transformation and interesting information about Argentinian history. And while you're at the website, check out the archive that now has over 50 episodes. And if you want to dig deeper, there's a category specifically for conflict transformation. I'm happy to say that it is now possible for you to support Fractal Friends, and you can make a donation through PayPal, or you can become a patron of Fractal Friends through Patreon, where you can subscribe to make a contribution for each episode. Patrons will receive gifts of gratitude and access to exclusive content. You can find buttons to make contributions on the episode page at fractalfriends.us. And as you heard before, I am dedicated to transforming conflict and helping the world improve its capacity to communicate across our differences. If you know teams or groups that need support to become collaborative, loving, and powerfully effective, send them my way. I am the Chief Transformation Officer at Spoke and Wheel, and we would love to have a free call with you. You can schedule a call with us at spokeandwheel.co. That is spokeandwheel.co. This episode was recorded on International Indigenous Peoples Day in August of the year 2020. And now please enjoy this conversation with Pablo Lumerman. Well, Pablo, I am so glad to have you on Fractal Friends, and I'm excited to be back in touch with you. It's been so many years since we like saw each other in person, but anyways, welcome to Fractal Friends.
Thank you, Duncan. It's a pleasure to be in Fractal Friends with you.
I know you both as a colleague and a friend, and I met you when I was living in Buenos Aires. And you were the executive director of Fundación Cambio Democrático, or the Foundation for Democratic Change, which is part of Partners Global, or Partners for Democratic Change, I think it used to be called. I also, we did a project together. We wrote a paper. And I want to just give you a chance to sort of introduce yourself as, how do you describe yourself and the work that you do in this world?
Well, first, let me recognize that this opportunity of talking with you was a special one. I was expecting this conversation because the last time we were together, I remember in Buenos Aires, you gave me this book with a note, and in that note, you echoed future meetings, future dialogues. And the book that you gave to me as a present was called The Power of Now, mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Eckhart Tolle. I didn't know the author, and I knew thanks to you, and it was a very interesting approach to life and to its meaning and to how to live well. And that title struck me in those times, The Power of Now. And having this opportunity just to feel this now moment, you know, and saying, okay, it happened. We are back. How long has it been, Duncan?
It's been 5.5 years, maybe.
So a lot of things happened to this world in this last half a decade, right?
Yeah, I appreciate just like being in this place of the now. And it's always like really profound to think about the impact that our past has on us, right? You know, like my life is different because of our relationship, the work that we did together. And, you know, of course, we're always looking to see where things are going. And I think, you know, particularly, you know, given like our professional interests, you know, we're really trying to think about how do we transform our relationships and like the world, the socioeconomic issues and so forth. But really like part of like the essence of like conflict transformation work, conflict resolution work, is to bring everyone to like the present. Right? Like, where are we right now? Like, what is the context? Like, what is the need? You know, and we can lose ourselves. And like, yet the past and the future have such influence on that, right? Like, you need to be able to understand the present in the context of the past and in the context of the future. And actually, I'm thinking about like Jean-Paul Lederach's like the moral imagination. And he has like this chart where he's saying that like, you need to understand like the immediate past in a conflict. You need to understand the recent past. You need to understand the past is that everyone can remember. And then you also need to remember the history or the cultural history. And that similarly, like when you're thinking about what's next, when you think about what do we do next, what do we do in the short term, what do we do in the medium term? And then like, what do we want to do for future generations? And we have to take all of this into context, but then you're still in the present. And I think today's Indigenous Peoples Day also, right? So there's also something about, we have to hold this huge, huge context.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Lederach talks about the 200 years present.
Mm-hmm.
So he connects this with the idea that when you were a baby, you were held by maybe your grandfather or your great grandfather, who was maybe 80 years old. And then when you will be 80 years old, you will be holding maybe a grandson or grand whatever. And then that connection takes you to the future of that little boy or girl that you're holding, you know? So if you calculate, it's more or less 200 years, more or less 200 and something. So yeah, it's a lot. It's a long present that we have to be conscious that we are living in. If we go beyond our own individualities and we connect with the transgenerational dimension of our lives, right?
Yeah, and what I like about that idea of that 200-year present is that that's like the amount of time that you can actually impact like directly, and that you can like directly understand, which of course is a ton of time, you know, the amount of things that happen in 200 years.
Yeah. So I was unfair because I didn't answer your question regarding my background.
Yeah. Well, who are you right now?
Well, my name is Pablo. I'm very happy to be here with you. Feel like I am in your house, Duncan, in Cipolletti, in the north of a very famous region called Patagonia, in the Argentinian side, Patagonia, but in the north valley. And it's a very nice place, low density. Yeah, that is good in terms of, you know, COVID sensitivity, great valley. And I'm living here with my family for the last 5 years, returned to this land after a big season in the capital city in Buenos Aires. And then in Buenos Aires was where we met, working in Cambio Democratico, this institution that was a school of many that, like me, wanted to take mediation to the public sphere, you know, dialogue, social conversations that had a meaning. And through that type of processes, having a collective impact, you know, that kind of aspiration that affected anybody that went to that institution or other similar institutions that in the world look for this, you know, applying dialogue, mediation, pluralistic processes, however you want to call them, in order to take the social problems, social conflicts, and transcend the ways that the conflicts are framed in order to get us a vision of the future. That type of activities, I think, is for me, it's like a vocation, it's a calling, you know, to participate, to contribute as a facilitator, sometimes, you know, having more a voice, you know, saying, well, what about this? What about this subject? Sometimes facilitating the conversation, sometimes involving myself in it and proposing. But anyhow, looking for understanding better the scenario where we are inserted as a generation, what's this crisis about, for instance, this moment in the civilization evolution. What does it mean to us, and what type of action does this scenario demands from us? So those are the questions I'm now working with from my condition as a mediator, professional mediator, but also as a citizen of my country, of my region, of the world, with my mate.
For those who are wondering what mate is, in Argentina and in Paraguay, there's a plant called yerba mate, and in the United States, like, we've bottled it, and just people brew it, and it's just bottled, and people drink it just as a tea.
Right.
But it's a huge part of your culture, and something that I really come to appreciate. Makes me think I should pull my mate out and drink some yerba one of these days.
Yerba, claro. And it's because it has an indigenous origin, of course, like anything in the Americas. That you go deep, you get indigenous. And in the case of mate, it was this bush that grew in the forest, in the rainforest of what is now Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, and Paraguay, and some of the Bolivia, that had yerba mate as a wild bush, right? And the Guaranis, the indigenous nations that lived in those areas, they used it. It was called then by the Jesuits, who were very, very big in those areas, the green gold. And it's in Syria. The Syrians, they use it a lot as well, like this, like me, like Argentinians. So it's kind of an international beverage now. But this way, with the mate and stuff, only in this region and in Syria and some other places.
In Syria, in the Middle East, people are drinking mate in a regular way?
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
And because of the migrations, the Syrian-Lebanese migrants that came in the late 1800s, They arrived to the region, to South America, Brazil, a lot of Syrian-Lebanese. So now family goes back and forth and takes the mate, you know, do some bridges.
Yeah.
Mate bridges from diasporas and their cousins.
What's interesting about this, or just that part of the story, is really just like noticing that like everything we do like has this ripple out over time. And that there was like someone who brought mate, introduced it to their family, and then they introduced it to their other family. And then it became like this cultural thing. And we can imagine that in 100 years or 200 years or 1,000 years, you know, like people all over the Middle East drinking mate and not really knowing where it came from or what, you know, like it. And so it's just the reminder that like every action we have is like rippling out in all these different directions. I think it's really powerful. Mm. I mean, I really appreciate though, like some of the like the themes that you brought up, and I want to, we'll definitely like get into like this like vocation of being like a dialogue practitioner in a bit. But I given sort of how we started, I want to actually touch on this theme of history, and I'm curious. So you're living in this like, you know, rural Patagonia now, or less urban than Buenos Aires.
Yeah.
And is that where you're from?
I was raised, yeah, here. I was born in Buenos Aires, but when I was very little, my father, who is a psychiatrist, I was hired by the Neuquino government. That is a province that is very, is here in this same region. They wanted to develop the public system, the public health system, and they needed professionals. So they hired people from Buenos Aires, Córdoba, the main capitals of Argentina, to build up the state services for this new region that was like the recently incorporated in the national territory called Patagonia. Just 120 years ago, this wasn't Argentina nor Chile. This was Indian territory called the, you know, different ways, different. They called it Huel Mapu, the indigenous peoples here, the Mapuche people. So going back, I was raised here in this region, but at the same time with this old root. And then I came back for, you know, uprising my kids and living here. The idea was to get grounded, because in Buenos Aires, I didn't feel that I could do my grounding, you know, in terms of having my feeling that where is my place? Where do I belong to? I felt that I belonged to this ground, this land. So I came back.
And that's like such an important, you know, part of life, is being able to, one, being able to find your ground, and also to like be able to find your center. I mean, after Argentina, when I moved back to the United States, it was like a big, important homecoming for me. I mean, also to be, this is actually my home and where I'm from, after being traveling and like being around the world so much. It was very profound for me to let myself be from here. It's just like an important lesson in life to be able to know when is the time to come home, and like how much like being at home can be powerful. Since you started to talk about it, and I think it could be interesting for those who aren't familiar with Argentinian history, would you be willing to unpack a bit about like how Patagonia became part of Argentina and Chile, and how because that conquest was like a big part of Argentinian history. And interestingly, I know that it was inspired by, though very different from, the United States experience with its indigenous populations. And anyways, well, I'd be interested to hear some of your, like how you might tell that story of the land that you're in.
For me, it was a discovery. Even though I was raised here and I went to school, the way I learned history in those times when I was young, a kid or young, was too schematic and did very little to make me understand what was the real history of the land I was living in. So I had to discover it by facing the conflicts, the present conflicts around the land and between identities, and the relation between the state and the current children of the indigenous peoples nowadays. So I learned the history by being involved actually in those type of conflicts, being myself, defending positions, understanding positions. But I didn't learn that from school. That this is something that probably I share with a lot of people of my age. So life made me learn that, for instance, so till 1880, this whole region was part of this huge autonomy, indigenous autonomy, that went from the Atlantic, the Salinas Grandes, the big salty lakes of the Buenos Aires province, till the Pacific. And that was all a political autonomy that responded to Mapuche leaders. It was kind of a proto-state for 40 years, from 1840 to 1880. But before that, it was also belonged to the indigenous peoples that had different type of arrangements and treaties with the state. First with the Spanish crown, and then with the independent states of South America, especially Argentina and Chile. In those times, a little bit earlier, also we had the struggle with the Great Britain regarding Malvinas, the Falklands, they say. We say Malvinas, also in Patagonia, and two islands that are in the Patagonian Sea, right? And I introduce in this history, this conquest, how do you call it, competition, how do you say, when everybody's running a race to annexing territories in this new land distribution in the Novecento, in the early century, in the late 1800s and early 1900s. Those times, the frontiers weren't defined. Those were the times where the frontiers, the national frontiers, were defined, the current ones. So we were facing also the risk of war between Chile and Argentina for the land that also was being conquered over the indigenous peoples that were there between Chile and Argentina. So you will see a lot of stories of indigenous communities escaping from the whites, from Chile and from Argentina, while the armies and the colonization were expanding the frontier and occupying more land and displacing more people. So you will see the crossings. And now you will hear a lot of Argentinians say, oh, the Mapuche, they come from Chile, saying mm-hmm. They don't have any right because they are Chileans. Let the Mapuche have to go back to Chile. It's difficult for the Chileans to say the same regarding the Mapuches that come from Argentina, because the culture, the Mapuche culture, was very rich in that side of Patagonia, Gulumapu, the west side. They were very intense. The culture, the Mapuche culture, had kind of a center, even though it's not a center, in that side. So it's difficult for Chileans to neglect their Mapuche backgrounds. But anyhow, they do. Actually, their constitution do not recognize them, and they have a more intense conflict between the Chilean society with the Mapuche people there. Much more intense and little than in this side, in Argentina. Mm-hmm. But wow. That's more or less some hints of the early history of Patagonia as part of Argentina. And myself, I find myself coming like in the late 1980 as a kid, with all the in this state building process, and right. With the privilege of the white as being very present. Mm-hmm. So again, the learning of the history coming from the living of the present, because no one told me when I was a kid about these stories, the stories of genocide, the occupation.
What I find interesting about Argentina and Argentinian history are the similarities with the United States and the differences, right? We in both cases have, European power, arriving in some land that's populated by indigenous people. and setting up camp and deciding that this is ours and pushing back, you know, the indigenous populations. There's like a really big difference in the way that the Spanish related to indigenous peoples and the way that the English related to indigenous peoples. You know, there was the, you know, the English were just like, we're superior and you're not supposed to be here. And they, you know, either and basically just like kind of took their land over, while the Spanish had kind of the spirit of like, we're going to make you Catholics. And, you know, there was a lot more of that conversion things. But then still, by the time you get to there being like Argentina and Chile, these independent countries, then like that idea of taking the land away. But then I think what's so similar is this experience of the people from like the dominant culture and the way there's like white Argentinian culture.
Yeah, I would say European or Western. More than Western, Argentinian, yeah. You know, because that's the very similar. I mean, it's any American, European-based migrant.
Right, exactly.
Because we had, actually, there is a lot of presence of British around here. And the British way of dealing with Native Americans or indigenous peoples also permeated a lot the culture in Patagonia.
Yeah, that makes sense, right.
Because actually, it permeated a lot the way that modern states that were built in those times, you know, the idea of the white man's burden, the racism. Also, I'm not sure about the genocidal idea of eliminating, you know, indigenous peoples from the land as a part of a planned process, you know, like let's improve the blood of the people. You know,
mm-hmm.
That idea was inserted in a generation that a generation that built, that had the vision of Argentinian nation. They were very influenced by a positivistic approach to life and also a lot of Eurocentrism or racism based on whites.
Right. One of the things that's like, you know, in the United States, it's like we're having yet again, or this long, slow process, which is actually very concentrated right now, of acknowledging the history of racism and the history of oppression and dominance, that this experience of realizing that one is white and that they have this like specific historical power, and then having to come to terms with the history of what you have done or what your ancestors have done, you know, it's like this powerful experience that a lot of people are going through. And it's interesting because, like you were saying, like, you know, in your childhood, that wasn't part of the story. You didn't hear about that. And similarly, like, I didn't necessarily, I mean, I knew obviously that there was slavery in the United States and there was some sort of conquest of the West in the United States, but not really understanding the detail, while those peoples do remember the story. And what is interesting is, like, you know, as an adult for you and for me, like, it was probably I was in my early 30s when I like finally had to like really face racism and privilege and all these things. But it's interesting how, and this is a little bit because I know like a little bit of your background, that like you're doing this work where you're like helping with like a conflict about some mining or some use of land or some political social conflict. And all of a sudden these people are here and they're saying, hey, this used to be ours and it got taken away from us and we remember. And then now you have to face this history. And I'm curious what the experience is of whiteness in Argentina. Like, is that part of the discourse of people realizing that, like, we are white or our European background is a significant part of our historical story?
It's part of the, it explains the privileges. No, it's not. In Argentina, it's not established that we have racist cultural frameworks. And that permeates any social sphere. But you will see it because even though it's not conscious, at least there is certain degree of consciousness in some groups, but it's not something that is being discussed openly about the racial bias. Depending on the color mm-hmm. of the skin, your voice will be more legitimated or heard, but it's obvious that if you see the elite the decision-making elite anywhere in the country, you will see whites, white people, or European origin, some maybe Turkish, some Middle East in some regions, you can see.
Yeah.
But see this migration, you know? So it's not that the same in other places in Latin America, in South America. You won't see that in Bolivia now. So in the last 30 years, there has been an empowerment of the indigenous movements, the consciousness about our past. So it's not that, but the idea that we are a racist society, no, it's not.
Yeah.
It's not recognized. And that's the problem. Because if you don't have that perspective, then you won't understand why you have a conflict. Why are they so mad? Why? People are perplexed sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they so angry? We didn't do anything to them.
Yeah, and we're not doing anything now. And I'm not racist. That's, yeah.
We are good people, good citizens. So,
yeah.
And why are they break the law? Why do they break the law? They are not citizens that obey the law like anybody. Like those types of reflections or kind of perplexities tells you a lot about how much consciousness there is about this, and also the difficulties to culturally go beyond the conflict, you know, to find a new higher ground with shared values, you know, shared life, learning from each other, from that diversity, compensating, remediating the harm that has been done, dealing with the transgenerational trauma that you can see anywhere in this type of scenes. There's a lot to work to make peace, positive peace, to build peace.
Yeah. I'm glad that like we got going down this thread, because it is something that's so, which is such a powerful thing, and it's something that's like built into life. And it's, I don't know, it feels useful for me to just recognize the contrast, because at least in the United States, like there is like an understanding of white privilege, and this is like, you know, it's permeating our culture, and that's like really finally happening. I mean, and like this year in particular is like really spreading a lot. And you know, I definitely want to get into like how this impacts conflict in a moment, but I also wanted to just like, I remember, just point this story out, that like I remember in Argentina, like it was like, it's a very segregated society as well. Like I remember that there's like, you know, the big grocery stores, but like a small grocery store in Buenos Aires is called a Mercado Chino, which is a Chinese market. And because the Chinese have small grocery stores. And then if you went to a vegetable store, it was run by Bolivians. And if there was a worker doing manual labor, it was a Paraguayan. And that was maybe not always true, but generally relatively true. And it was just so interesting that you could just go from like a place to place to place, and you could just see that cultural, you know, segregation. And there's like another thing that I thought was like really interesting. There's like a contrast. I was dating a woman from Argentina, and, you know, who has come from like European white background. And it was very perplexing to her that she's like, wait, if I come to the United States, will I be a person of color? And like, because I'm Latina, you know, and will I be seen as someone? And then like, it's interesting to also notice that relative experience of to have white privilege in Argentina and then come to the United States and then become an immigrant and then be in some sort of marginalized population is like, you know, just pointing out that this whole system of cultural, racial dominance is so complex, and it's so built into our history that unless we like make it explicit, it's like kind of hard to see and hard to understand like just how pervasive it is. But just so we can like get into like some of like this work around like conflict transformation and things like that. When we were working together, I had just done my master's thesis on mining conflicts in Argentina. It was the time of Famatina, just to like, you know, put that in perspective. And then one of the things that was happening is like one of the laws that existed in Argentina that made it possible for people to say, no, we don't want to have some multinational corporation come here, was that there was a law that says that indigenous peoples have to give consultation before their land is being used for mining.
Yeah, that's a treaty that was signed, but it was a general, it's the ILO 169, called Convenio 169, 169 accord or treaty by the ILO that Argentina incorporated in its constitution after the 94th reform. Yeah, that gave the indigenous peoples the right of prior consultation to any project that would affect their livelihoods.
Right. And I wonder if you could just, maybe you could think of an example of one of the conflicts that you know of, or can you just give us like a window into like, what are some of the examples of like the socio-political conflicts that like the Foundation for Democratic Change was working on when you were there that feel really prevalent in Argentina? So we can get a sense of how the now, you know, which we know a bit of the history, like what that looks like.
Well,
yeah.
Let me tell you a story about Villa La Angostura. That is a little village in the very, like in the Andes, but it's a rainforest of very deep in the Andes frontier with Chile. It's kind of, the scene is very like paradisiac because you have such big lakes. It's kind of a paradise, you know, that area of the world, close to the Nahuelhuapi Lake. So that region, as any of the Patagonia, was well disputed, right? And what you have now is that area is an area that is used by, it's very much visited because of the beauty, by tourism from all over the world, very high-class tourism. So there is this typical tourism-based municipality that needs to develop more services to the tourism, and there are interests based on the land, urban developments, you know, new buildings. You can see how the city grows on top of the forest, right? It takes out the forest and expands the margin of the city, you know, with new closed developments or big houses bought by millionaires that wanted to have, you know, this house in the paradise. That kind of investment produces also a displacement of people that do not have the means to deal with that pressure, and they are bought out or they resist, and then they are displaced anyhow. And that happens with especially to the community that was the owner of the whole area, that back in the days when Argentina conquered this land, Roca, that was a general that was in charge of the army that did the work of the conquest and then was president, he gave this community, the two communities, Paichil and Treao, now they are one community, Paichil and Treao, Mapuche. Roca, the winner, gave the community the land, certain land, you know, kind of a reduction, you know. So, okay, now you go there. This is yours. This is for you. And we keep the rest, okay? There wasn't any alternative for them, so they accepted, right? It was like, I don't know, 5,000 hectares or something, all this land. So in the last 100 years, this community lost the 65% of the land that was gave to them, you know, because of all the urbanization process, you know, white state, mm-hmm. investment, displacement, and people, and, you know, city, and inhabitants, and dynamics. And so that, and currently you have an ongoing conflict between this community and one new development that is being activated there by people with big money. And they have other problems with the state, with the national state, with the national parks as well. So they have all these type of conflicts with the society and the state and the private sector. And you don't understand why they are so conflictive if you don't see the story. You know?
Right.
Why are these Mapuche people so... they are in conflict all the time, you know?
Right. First of all, we gave up all of our land just to have this small piece of land. And then we had most of it stolen in a little bit. And now they want to take this one more piece. And
they are, come they are on. Fighting it. Why?
Enough. Yeah.
And sometimes you have situations where you have violence. And sometimes they are institutional violence, such as, I don't know, a contract or a new law or, you know, a new paper. They call it paper, you know. And one Mapuche friend of mine said, the paper sings. The paper can sing, you know, saying the power of the paper. And they didn't have the power of the paper because that came from, you know, Western culture. But at the same time, they got good in paper and they are very good writers of letters because they have in their culture, their parliamentarian society. So they have in the culture the dialogue, but they want to engage in dialogue in order to resolve conflicts. The problem is that they are not identified as legitimate others because of the cultural, you know, bias, racism, lack of understanding of the history. So the legitimization of the voice of them is now a little bit stronger than before, but still in a process. So that's the story. It's a current story. You can see Villa La Angostura and Pachili Antriao as a community with tensions and conflicts. And my involvement there is helping the parties, especially the Mapuche, to have enabling environments to engage in productive dialogue in order to transcend this 100 years conflict to a new scenario where we can have enriched forest, you know, regenerative culture with, you know, with the restoration of the natural forest together with the national park, having, traditional health strategies, you know, access to health by traditional means, using the plants of the forest as input, as a medicine, you know, as in Spanish, we call it medicina tradicional, traditional medicine.
Yeah.
So there is a lot there, you know, nowadays that the health issue is so big. We have so much to do if we get like together, thinking from the same perspective, arranging the conflicts between uses of the territory, looking for better ways of coexisting and protecting nature and, you know, regenerating the forest, the communities, the relations, you know, healing, in a healing process. We can engage in a political healing process if we give space to dialogue, and that's more or less the bet. You know, there is a lot to gain out from these type of processes, and we can see it.
There's a couple of pieces there that I think are just, thank you. It's a really good example, and I am really interested to learn more about this. And by the way, anyone who's listening to this, like all the resources for all this information, I'll make sure will be on the episode webpage so people can learn more about all these issues and things we've talked about in history. But first of all, like I've noticed that there's this interesting parallel between colonialism and gentrification, that in a way, like colonialism is just like a large scale gentrification in this certain way, right?
Geopolitical and gentrification.
Yeah, exactly. But then I'm also noticing that there's a certain level of cultural colonialization, gentrification that's happening. That, like, the Mapuche being this parliamentarian community that uses dialogue as part of their culture, right? Then you have the European descendant folks with, like, we're using this legal system with, we've got our papers and then, like, our treaties and the laws and, you know, not a history of dialogue, right? Like, we don't, like, dialogue's not part of that. And those of us that work in this field of dialogue and conflict transformation or circle process, we understand that this is an ancient process, that this comes from indigenous peoples all around the world that have used dialogue as a way of dealing with certain kinds of issues. And so it's interesting to then have, you know, this kind of new version of this dialogue process that has been spread around the world over the last couple of decades, you know, with this field of conflict transformation folks and conflict resolution folks and dialogue folks. Think of like the art of hosting and just all these wonderful dialogue processes that are drawing on these like ancient systems. And then there's like you coming in there as this person who's able to be on this, like this interface between like a traditional dialogue process, who's also bringing in all this new modern conflict transformation tools and helping them be in this interface so they can like, let's talk about our land and let's do this in a way that can get, first of all of us to talk to each other. And it's just interesting to think about not only when that land got taken over and like got urbanized, but also the culture of treaties and papers took over the culture of dialogue, and that there's this returning of this culture of dialogue, and that it needs the you know, professional who understands dialogue, cares about the indigenous peoples, understands the history, to like sort of help support this conversation. You know, it's complex, you know, and complexity, of course, is like the whole thing. It's like actually in these states of complexity, like that's where dialogue and being inclusive of the different perspectives comes in the best. Hi, Fractal friends. Sorry for the interruption. I'll keep this one quick. So are you part of a team or a group or an organization? I bet that you are. Actually, I bet that you're part of a few of them. Whatever your purpose is, I know that for you to be successful, you need to be able to count on the web of relationships that hold you together as you work towards your mission. It's hard sometimes to find a balance between being effective, acting decisively, and getting things done on one hand, while also cultivating a safe, caring, joyful, and collaborative environment on the other. But it is vitally important that your group both strikes and sustains that balance between people and purpose. So how's your team doing? Are you getting along? How are you adapting to the changing context that we're all in? Is your team struggling to work together to achieve its life-affirming purpose? If so, I would love to talk to you. In my company, Spoke and Wheel, we call ourselves the Workplace Relationship Experts, and we believe that great relationships are what drive great organizations. Whether you're part of a big company or a small startup or something in between, we've got you covered. Or maybe you're part of a group or organization that's working for political and social change. We've got that covered too, through our partnership with Mediators Beyond Borders International. And as a bonus, we are designed to work with remote teams in a 100% virtual environment. So wherever you are, whatever you're doing, if you are ready to transform your relationships and get your crew to be happily moving in the same direction again, we're here for you. Come on over to spokeandwheel.co and schedule a free call with us. Again, that is spokeandwheel.co. And now, back to the show.
Oslo, Hong Kong, wherever, like connecting, you know, sharing certain capacities to understand each other, even though sometimes we may fall in between the interpretation lines. But and that happens with the Mapuche. I'm also have an ethnic background. I'm a Jewish, so I have my indigenous people. I have my tradition. I have my, you know, I also have stories of being, you know, slaves and killed and prosecuted. And, you know, so now I have privilege. Of course, my generation does, but, you know, so just being aware of that, us being historical, you know, people also confronting ourselves with the crisis of the whole world that is also integrated by this civilization order, whatever you can call it, that makes us so close at the same time. That is the complexity of the present, I feel. And apart from that, the problem is that this civilization order that integrated us all and reduced the differences between the Mapuche, the Jewish, the Anglo-Saxon, the whatever, reduce the difference and make all of us asymmetrically coexist, now is in crisis. There is a huge crisis of that civilization that we are all in. And we have to give some meaning of that. What happens? What is happening? And then it's something that it's very good to say, okay, as humans, we made ourselves, you know, with all these stories, we got to this point that we are, you know, populating this planet too much and we are provoking this planetary crisis. The way we live, the way we relate with each other and with the nature is putting us in a situation of existential threat, not only to our species, but to any species. So that is something that is also complex to face. It's very complex. And to have, not only to be, okay, overwhelmed by the feeling, but also have a concrete action to, in order to respond to that situation. So all that comes into place when we act politically in the face of the future. That is something that is beyond the ones that are dedicated to conflict resolution. And we need, in that sense, to have a critical understanding of our own foundations, but also some interest, not only critic, but also revive or revitalize, for instance, the bet to the logos. That is very Western and Greek. The logos, you know, the words, the reason, the capacity to, you know, build together, you know, imagine together. The use of that is something that is very well rooted in Western culture. Not only the papers that are used to impose orders, but also the logos that habilitate us to understand each other and to act together. So we have a lot in our own tradition and in the traditions of other peoples, and especially in the traditions of the traditional societies that are alive today in this present, we can get a lot of learnings, a lot of wisdoms in order to bet for the future and act towards the future, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I believe very strongly, and it's kind of this interesting, like, recurring theme in this podcast, that, like, in order to survive into the future, we're going to have to find the balance between indigenous and traditional wisdom and modern wisdom. You know, as you said, we're all interconnected. There's not some sort of, like, pure history. We're not going to get all the Europeans to go back to Europe and have the pure Mapuche, like, take over. You know, like, we're all mixed up now. So it's all happening. We're all sharing each other's culture and stuff. But that knowledge and that history, like, the Mapuche have something very powerful to bring to Vixe La Angostura. And part of that is, like, what you were saying is, like, they're asking for, can we, like, have the development here, or, like, the future of this be sustainable, be, like environmentally grounded? Can we, like, start bringing back traditional medicine? And that's not just them saying, hey, we want it to be back like it used to be for us. It's actually saying, hey, we have a proposal here about how we can make this be sustainable for everyone who's here right now. And, like, we have some answers for you that you don't have the answers for. One of them includes dialogue as a process and not just being dependent on some sort of laws that are super slow and easy to corrupt and things. But then also, we have ways of living with this land, you know, that we can offer, and that, like, we actually need these wisdoms to come together, like that interconnected, you know, paper-based system and being in tune with the environment. And because just, like, unsustainable, let's just take down some more trees and plant some more things. That's the part where we are facing that kind of environmental collapse, social collapse, and all these issues. I want to lift out something that you said earlier, though, that I think is, like, a really interesting. People, well, I think when they think about, like, mediation in particular, like, there's this idea of neutrality. And then there's this, actually, really, one of the things I think is really powerful about conflict transformation, and again, I'm thinking about Lederach talking about this in one of his books on conflict transformation right now, about, like, cross-cultural conflict transformation, is that it's not actually about being neutral. And, like, you mentioned how, like, you're helping with this conflict, but you're specifically helping with the Mapuche people. And one of the things that's important is that if you're going to really transform the conflict, if the power is imbalanced, like step one is to make sure that there's a power balance, right? And so that's, first of all, people getting educated, but then it's also, and this is where protests can come into play, you need to get that level of capacity to be able to engage with that system to be more equal so that when they go to the negotiating table and actually talk about how they want to build the future, they can actually just like engage more or less as equals. And do you know which one I'm talking about? It's like the Adam Curl like graph where there's this kind of like the stages of change. And like at first it's different. Yeah.
The asymmetry, they need to correct the asymmetry and sometimes the mobilizations and other forms of community organization is part of the effort to level the playing field and have what lawyers say, equality of arms.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the concept of neutrality was very much criticized by anybody that tried to use mediation or other forms of problem solving, you know, using conflict resolution techniques. That principle of neutrality was not proper to be used. I mean, you get neutrality when you have a very established system, you know, that does all that arrangement and equality of arms and all that equalizing by itself. And that what you have to do is operate the process as an operator. You have to be impartial and whatever, neutral. But because of the system does the work of doing those balancing efforts and enabling and the warrants and the human rights and everything is dealt with by the system, and you get the parties, and then you are impartial, right? Even then, you have to be cautious on that impartiality or that neutrality, because you may incur, your intervention may incur in the prolongation of the conflict by reinforcing the asymmetric relation and the power relation between one and the other, you know, and the oppression. Yeah, structural violence. You can reinforce that. That's what Bernie Mayer, he said, let's confront the conflict resolution field, saying neutrality is not a good formula.
Yeah.
We need to engage in the conflict. We need to do strategic engagement, disruptive engagement in order to impede the reproduction of the same pattern that will make the conflict recur once and again with very, you know, higher costs for everybody, especially for the most vulnerable.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. I was so glad to finally have found that book, the by Bernard Mayer, Beyond Neutrality. Like, it's really powerful. And right, because there's like so many challenges here. Like, first of all, like, yeah, like as you were saying, that if you go into a situation that's unequal or is in a broken system and you're just impartial or neutral about it, like things will naturally, like you're just going to reestablish that same imbalance in power. And so there's a way that it can be extra dangerous because you can sort of like get people to consent to a system that's like not working for them just by not caring.
Let me give you an example. We are in the midst of a crisis, you know, a global economic, social, sanitary crisis. And in this crisis, you have a lot of conflicts going around because of, you know, the COVID just exaggerated, put it strong light, illuminating like all amplified the problems, all the flaws of the system.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have an acute moment of this crisis. And if we are neutral and we operate with that neutrality in the conflict, we won't be at all useful for the transition, for our own well-being. I mean, we need to be very much engaged in what is happening and connected with, you know, everybody, but especially our needs in this moment. And of course, looking at the future, right? So we need to have values there. So transition, planetary boundaries, low carbon energy. We have some formulas, you know, on what type of society is sustainable for the world. We cannot be neutral between the ones that go for that and the ones that resists that and wants to go back to the normality that we had when we were like the kings of the universe.
Yeah.
No mediation. I mean, yeah, we need dialogue. Of course, we need to understand, but we cannot be neutrals between one and two. I don't feel that is a right position and productive position to remain neutral in that discussion.
Absolutely. I mean, especially, I mean, I really appreciate you just like naming this moment. Like, we are in a time of like, we need deep transformation. We cannot be neutral in the face of, you know, this global need for an upgrade. And whether that's the environment or international like relationships, whatever it is, like it's time for us to engage and be willing to change. And we have to address the underlying system. And again, this is about addressing that whole deep history and then also the deep future that we're looking towards. There's also thinking about this idea of just like the cultural or the intellectual colonialization theme. The reason why we have neutrality as a concept is because the idea is that a judge is supposed to be neutral, right? And the reason why a judge needs to be neutral is because they are the voice of the state or of the paper or of the laws. Right. So a judge comes into a situation and they have their own personal experience, their own family, their own background, their own history. But when they like face the situation, their opinion doesn't really matter. What matters is what does the law say about this? Right. So it's interesting to notice how this concept of neutrality has like colonized our minds as mediators, because a mediator doesn't necessarily need to be neutral. It's actually way more helpful if they can go into an experience not only and actually be conscious and aware of their own biases, their own background, and also be able to name that, and then also being able to say, you know, so it's important for me to be able to say, look, this is my, like, here's me, I'm a human here, helping you all have a human conversation, but then also be able to say, and I care about every person who's here, and that's like that added value.
That would be a restorative judge.
Right.
So a new type of judge, close with parties and work with them, how to heal the situation, how to deal with the conflict from a restorative approach. That's another model or paradigm of justice, more typical of the traditional societies, but also very much present in our community-based conflict resolution modes in our Western world as well. The problem is the bureaucratization of the conflict resolution system. And the problem that gives, of course, the bureaucracy needs neutrality to operate, but it's a fiction. I mean, and it also it's charged. You have charged the system in favor of certain order. I mean, that is unfair. So why to be operators of, you know, system guardians? Yes, it works, but it doesn't work. Come on. From other point of view, I wanted to react on something. This idea, this Cartesian idea of separating body and mind and separating, you know, feelings from judgings and the law from the people. And, you know, we have to apply the law not dealing with people. I mean, those are not only fictions, social arrangements or institutions and ways that I'm not sure they've done good things. I mean, the accumulative effect is not that good. I mean, at least for our so peripheral societies. So yes, I see that there is a need of democratization of the state functions of the justice system towards a more caring, healing justice process with more caring and healing justice operators. And hopefully that will come because I feel the need of that from the people that are now exercising roles of, you know, justice operators, and they want to really solve conflicts and not reproducing them and, you know, re-victimizing people. And they don't want that. And they are looking for the different spaces to, you know, accumulate these, you know, distortive effects or questioning effects, you know, to create alternatives that are also much, so much better in the effects. So that is, I see the paradigm shifting. I see it. Hopefully it will be on such a pace, such a scale that will prevent us from going, you know, to darker ages, mm-hmm. more violent. That can happen as well. I mean, we have a future with different scenarios, and you have the bad ones, the very bad ones, and some of them are better for the future.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about this a little bit, but I guess I'm curious, you know, to think about maybe together, like, what might be some of those, like, positive future scenarios? And also, what is the role of, you know, these themes that we've talked about of conflict transformation and dialogue and you know, remembering our history in those future scenarios? Because it seems connected, right? Like, the positive future scenarios for me, like, include, one, there's a recognition of everyone, right? Like, that, like, it's not all of our different histories. There's about being present, you know, there's something about being very real about where we are right now. And part of doing that is being able to be in effective dialogue with each other. And then I also hear like a thread of this, like, you know, this remembering some of this indigenous history. So like this example of like what the Mapuche are offering in Villa La Angostura, how do we make a generative, healing possible future? Like, I mean, that seems like the direction that we want to go. I'm curious, where are some of the directions that you see things potentially going?
Well, I see a lot of examples of people building that those good scenarios in the future now. And I can give you some examples. In this case, in the Villa La Angostura case, this community, now they want to, again, give a sign of, you know, of an attitude, an open attitude towards, you know, parliamentarian engagement with the community. And on the other side, you have efforts from the state and from the private sector as well to engage constructively. There are people from the, you know, that have 30 years old, 40 years old. We all live under the same sun. And in these times, we are questioning a little bit our, you know, certain mandates. And what is happening is that there you have unconventional conversations going on from people that were like very, very conflictive and violent between each other. For instance, there is this developer called, I don't remember his surname, but he's there. He has actually a North American background, and he bought this land, and he bought it, but the land was Mapuche land. But again, he didn't know because he bought the paper, right? And then he found the Mapuche young people coming to his land, defending the land, saying, this is our land, and having that type of standoff, right? So he was involved in this conflict, and he used very bad means also. And there was this sacred space where that the community had in the forest that this guy wanted to become a kind of a garden, you know. What he did was cut the trees and, you know, arrange that in order to make, you know, part of his garden. But he kind of, not destroyed, but yeah, he didn't respect that sacred ground, you know. And he was conscious. He didn't want that to be Mapuche anymore because it will be there for Mapuche to come. So he wanted them out. So he destroyed the sacred site, you know. Mm-hmm. And at the end, and that created a lot of tension and bad feelings, and for a lot of years. And then now, this Mapuche spokesperson told me when we were discussing about the case that this guy, he said that he wanted to rebuild that with the Mapuche. Okay, mm-hmm. He wanted to move ahead. So there are moments of awakening. And if we take advantage of those moments of awakening that are very much related with moments of crisis where you don't know where to go, and you know, you question some of the mandates you had, and also you find new ways of moving forward, and that is what I see is happening there. You know, it can be an opportunity that can be left aside, not taking advantage of it because I don't know. people can be mindful of other business and not doing from that reimagination of the conflict something real. But if we get that exercise, you know, turn into a project, concrete project that we can then, you know, fund and develop, that can create a biocultural corridor all around that area, connecting lakes and mountains by collaborative effort between community, indigenous communities, and also white people, and making the tourism more amicable and more friendly to the forest itself, to the nature, healing the forest that is sick. Actually, we have a sick native forest there, healing it, and also making it better capable of capturing CO2 in order to reduce the climate change effect. You know, everybody would be happy. Those formulas are there. It's not that I'm inventing them. They are there. The thing is that they don't have enough press, voice, funding, whatever, yet. But if we portray them, if we focus on them, on the healing capabilities that these projects can have, then people will invest. And these future scenarios of better life together can happen. I'm a believer of that. Also realistic, that it's not probable. The prognosis is taking us to a very bad and dark direction. But we have therapeutics for this, and those therapeutics are based on dialogue and transforming hate into love emotions. You know, not that complex, but difficult.
I really love that example, and I really just appreciate that like, we have the ability to do. I think that's always like the message. It's like, listen, people, like we have the solutions to the problems that we have right now, you know, and they take like a bit of effort, and we're going to take some time, and we're going to have to actually talk to each other. But what I also really like about that story, and it's interesting how it like threads back into like the beginnings of our conversation about just like recognizing our history and you know, and the importance of sort of like, you know, white or European people, European ancestry, like understanding racism or understanding the impact of our history. This is a very like small example of a wrong happened, like something bad happened. The person was not necessarily aware that they were doing it, but they felt like they had the right to do it. And they like went and they like damaged this part of the land. And then that same person was able to realize, oh, wow, I've actually learned this lesson, you know, because someone came and told them like, hey, this wasn't okay. And probably at first they were resistant, and then eventually they came around. And then that opens up this possibility of this next step to say, okay, I want to work with you to restore this. And then now all of a sudden, then there's creating this opportunity for this land to be, not only is it improving the environment, it's potentially creating like something that's good for tourism, but then it's also creating something that is this small example of like a positive interaction between indigenous peoples and outside white folks in a way that's like the template for just like this much bigger transformation that we could have as a society, right? Like in the United States, to be able to say, wow, we really messed up by destroying indigenous land, enslaving Africans, and together, how can we make this right? Like, can we collectively, like, let's be in the dialogue now about how we start repairing this, and, or just, you know, globally, you know, like, there's so many different examples. The ultimate conflict being like the Middle East, and just like Israeli-Palestine conflict, and be like, wow, hey everyone, let's just acknowledge there's a massive wound that happened here, and like people were hurt. And what would it be like for us together to sort of build this future? And it's like, it's hard, but it's not that crazy, because all it takes is that shift in thinking, which is to be able to say, I'm going to just accept that I've made a mistake, which is hard for people to do, right? And that I recognize you as a partner and healing this mistake. And like, that's, you know, basically like the essence of it.
Yeah. And it's not only that, it's that I recognize that this situation that puts myself in a privileged position is always also hurting me, even though it looks like it benefits me. Even though it materially benefits me, morally, it degrades me. And I acknowledge that, and I want to transform that because I prefer my moral existence rather than my material existence. So I'm this from a position of somebody with privileges that is involved in a conflict, such as the one that I was mentioned, and recognize that also is a victim of the conflict, even though it plays the role of the super dog. It's also trapped by the conflict, the dark side of the conflict.
And I think that, you know, like with the piece that's like worthwhile catching in this, that is easy to disappear, but it fits into this beyond neutrality piece, is that, you know, it requires the person who has been harmed and oftentimes does not have the privilege or the power to actually step in and say, hey, this wasn't okay, right? So you have the young Mapuche folks coming in there and protesting, or just like that step of protest, of bringing resistance, is an important one because it brings attention and in a way elevates something to like, okay, well, this is something that's worth talking about. But then the next step is now let's engage in a dialogue on how we do this together. You know, because none of this would have happened if they were just angry and didn't say something, right? You know, like it took the person realizing that they had made a mistake.
Let me tell you something. In Chile, and also in Argentina, but in Chile, the conflict gets a little bit more violent and lethal. And you can see how there are deaths provoked by violent action coming from side the one side and the other side. But especially, you will see one case of these Chileans with an Austrian or Swiss background, the Luschingers, that were like this family, and this especially this old couple that were kind of the mother and father of the family. And they were traditional colonizers of this region in Chile. And they employed Mapuche people for their workings and stuff. And they were part of this huge ethno-political conflict that, you know, between the Mapuche people and the state of Chile and the society of Chile, and they were in the middle. And what happened was that you had an attack towards their house by what looks like a Mapuche group, where also a machi was involved, and somehow, you know, a medicine man, you know, legitimating the attack towards this couple. They burned the house down with a couple within. They had like a gunfire and a type of confrontation, and then the house was burned and the couple died. So you have that also, you know? So you can get the conflict in that direction. And then many Mapuches were imprisoned. The conflict is prolonged. And now, if you see nowadays, you see that all the south of Chile, all the Araucanía, is with a very active, very polarized conflict between Mapuche and Chileans, not only between the state and the community, but also between communities. So it's very painful. And so the violence, it's not only a like peaceful protesting, you know, no, it gets very rough, because many people in both sides see that you don't have a partner for peace. You mentioned Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the same, you don't have there is no partner for peace on the other side. So the only thing that we have is force, you know? They don't understand any other language, right? That type of justification of the prolongation of, you know, everlasting conflict, that is something can be transformed or not.
Well, I mean, this is, and it's actually really, like, I appreciate that example because this was recent, I suppose. You know, you can see there's like different stages of where this conflict can go, right? And so, right, in the case of this person in Angostura, like they heard the feedback, they responded, the people were willing to engage in dialogue, and then they actually, you know, started this dialogue, right? In this case, you know, that you share about in Chile, you know, first of all, obviously there's a history there. So like, this is like this long history. So there's deep anger. And then of course, like the idea of like, you know, attacking the house, killing the couple, burning the house is a way of saying that like, I don't want to talk to you, right? It would be hard for the children of that couple to then say, oh, wow, we really understand that you have like a really, you know, legitimate grievance here. Let's have a conversation about it, right? And of course, then of course, all the rest of the population in that region, it's like, it's hard to engage with that. And then of course, if we look at Israel and Palestine, we can find that that's, we have layers and layers and layers and decades and decades and decades of that. And it's hard to even tell who is the first person to burn the house down and kill the couple, because now it's like, well, then they burned down that house and then they burned down that house, or they blew up that house and then they blew up this thing, or they bulldozed that orchard. And so now everyone has this like deep, deep record of all of the problems, and everyone now has a legitimate grievance or something that they want to get retribution about.
Even there are asymmetries, there are superdogs and underdogs. Everybody has a grievance.
Yeah.
So, and the grievance, if you don't address the grievance, redress the grievance adequately, it turns into protracted hate.
Yeah. One of the other podcasts in this season that is with this guy named David Brubaker, and we talk about, he wrote a book called Leading in the Age of Polarization. We talk about like, what does it mean to be a leader in a polarized situation? And his formula is recognize your own dignity, recognize the dignity of the other person, and then speak your truth clearly, and then stay connected. And like, this is that piece of like, so, you know, to say, okay, I recognize my dignity that it's not okay for this land to be touched this way, right? I also recognize that this is another human being that did this. And then to say, and I'm not okay with it. I'm very clearly not okay with it. And I want to continue the conversation with you. And like that last step is the tricky one, because it's easy to confuse speaking your truth with the other person must be wrong.
And kicking the table.
Yeah.
It's wise. Connecting with your own identity first is needed, because if not, how can you stand? And then connecting with the dignity of the other in order to respect the other and its her or his trajectory. And then speaking what happens within you, and speaking about the relationship as well. You know, how are we relating? How I'm feeling about this.
Yeah.
And then staying connected just to see the reaction and to deal with that and to continue, right?
Yeah.
I think it's good to stay, you know, put on, even though if you have a voltage there, well, keep, you know, dealing with that voltage.
Yeah. And it's interesting, the formula for what creates polarization is, well, there's three parts of it, but one of them is like inequality, like the system is unequal. And then the other piece is that there's a stated grievance. And this is like what's happening. It's like, do I have something to argue about? But that inequality is like a huge part of it. But I think the point that everyone has like a history or a pain, and that's part of the recognizing the dignity of each other, is just like, can I just see that this still is a human? And it's just, I mean, it's, I don't know, I just feel like it's important to raise a ruckus. But when you are ready, when you have their attention, now then it's time to start talking to them. And it's hard to both fight and hold the dignity of the person, but it seems like a really key ingredient towards like how we build this new future. So Pablo, there's a question that I ask everyone who comes on the podcast, and you know, just like given your life experience, you know, Pablo Lumerman, living in Argentina and doing the work you do, what is something that you might invite people who are listening to pay attention to as they are trying to make a better life for themselves and the rest of the world?
Well, very simple things. Appreciating the life is something that is key, right? Being thankful for life. Sissy, I mean, it's not easy, but it's kind of simple. And I think it's fundamental in order to get the energy to intervene and to do things. First, cherish life with the lights and the shadows. I find myself better when I breathe consciously and when I connect myself with my body I recognize myself as a body that is on the ground. I think that gets you like a different type of wisdom, non-rational one. But I think it's very important to keep like the balance and eating well. I think be conscious of what we eat, with what we consume in general, eating and reading, and what do we put in our minds and in our souls, what we, in our bodies, what do we put there? That is something that makes me live better. Well, the Mapuche talk about the Kumefelen, the good living. In Jewish tradition, we say Lechaim, to the life, you know? So there is this idea of, you know, connecting with the awe of being alive and acting after, you know, that consciousness.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for that. I love how each of those are so connected to each other too. Being intentionally connected and appreciating life with all of its good and bad, you know, and hard and soft and difficult and easy and beautiful and ugly, but then appreciating the body and caring for the body and like appreciating like this mind, which is kind of this interface between like our body and spirit, you know, and then just like being just like, what part of life are we choosing to interact with, right? And that's like part of what consumption is, right? It's like, what do I decide to read or listen to or feed myself with? It's a crazy thing, this life, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you really think about it, if you don't really reach a point of awe, then think about it a little more. One of the best advices that I heard from a mediator is a workshop that I listened to when I first moved back to the United States. Was just taking 3 conscious breaths. And you can do that anytime. You know, you're just listening there. And it just like brings you back into your body. And like, it'll be fine. Whatever's happening will still keep on happening. But again, it's like the ripple out of just like being present, like being in the now, right? Has this impact. Or has this impact on those around you. Pablo, I'm really grateful for this conversation. I'm really excited about where we went and like what some of the things that we got to share here. And I really appreciate hearing your perspective again and being in touch with you. If people want to find out more about you or get in touch, how can they do that?
Thank you, Duncan. The pleasure was all mine. The possibility of engaging this type of dialogue, deep dialogue, the dialogue that is very much alive, is a source of inspiration for all the ones that are involved. So for me, I appreciate this opportunity because talking with you, listening to you, or your interpretations, your comments, your ideas, also improve my feelings, my ideas, my reactions. Yeah, and we build something together. Hopefully together with others that can join this conversation, other fractal friends of yours that will come and will share. And we'll build together this collective wisdom to have at least a good opportunity to transform that in some type of action, you know, testimony, and taking from there.
Yeah, it's a good example of the power of dialogue, right? How we grow together. Yeah. If people want to learn more about any of your projects or get in touch with you, is there a way to do that?
Yeah, social networking. I'm an active social networker. So Facebook, Pablo Lumerman, Sirote, or Twitter, Lumerman, or email, WhatsApp. We can then share some links. It would be great to engage after with anybody that feels that what we discussed today was something relevant.
Yeah, I think so too. Oh, I specifically wanted to check that project, you know, with the gentleman in Villa Langostura and the Mapuche. Is there a way that you'll be able to share resources with me about how people could invest in that or support that if they want to?
Well, yeah, I think we will get into that. I'm doing the assessment now. We are getting into a dialogue with the authorities of the community, presenting them a kind of an agreement to work together. as bridge builders with society, with the state, with investors, working very close with the, what they call the, their life plan, their plan de vida. So actually, we are in the midst of a prior consultation, applying the 169 ILO procedures that makes us have a really good dialogue with the community's leaders to identify the an agreements to act together, and in order to then, you know, open up the possibility of collaboration. I feel that in the following 2 weeks, we are going to get through that process, and then we will start to build up this biocultural corridor or project endorsements or backings or participation. And for sure, that project will need supporters and helpers and visitors, and it will be a kind of a live project. So it'll be great to connect to anybody that will be interested in that. Of course, with the leading role of the community and the community of Villa Langostura, we will be only facilitators, mediators, right?
Right.
For that connection to happen.
Absolutely. Wonderful. Well, people can follow up with you about that and get in touch with you through all of your social media accounts if they just want to learn more or get support. And Pablo, thank you so much for this.
Pleasure, Duncan. Anytime.
Thank you again for listening to this episode of Fractal Friends with Pablo Lumberman. You can find more content and links and resources about this episode, as well as other episodes at fractalfriends.us. And while you're there, sign up for the newsletter to get updates on new episodes and learn more about my work as the Chief Transformation Officer at Spoke and Wheel. Also, please consider donating to Fractal Friends with a small or large, if you'd like, financial contribution, or you can subscribe to be a patron. You can find buttons for that at the Fractal Friends website. Also at the website, you can find all the social media links to get in touch with Pablo. And you can learn more about me and my work at spokeandwheel.co. If you like this episode, take a moment to share it with someone. Let it inspire you to call a friend or share it on LinkedIn. I'm working really hard over here to do my part to amplify these voices and spread these messages, and I would love to have your support. And as usual, I'll close this out with a song. The song I want to share with you is Klezmer Tango by duo Lerner Mogilevsky. Pablo helped me find this Argentine Jewish music by the duo comprised of Marcelo Mogilevsky and Cesar Lerner. I hope that you enjoy it. You can find their full album at the episode page at fractalfriends.us and in the podcast episode notes. Thank you for listening to Fractal Friends. And remember, we all have a role to play in the whole.